Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshipper, lover of leaving, ours is no paragon of despair. Come yet again, come. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to UUFM on this very springy morning. First, I'd like to draw attention to some of the announcements that are printed in your bulletin. There are quite a few to choose from. A reminder that this month, the month of April, we are collecting toiletries and personal care products for the Crisis Center of Manhattan Emergency Shelter that is located out the door there. Also, any of you artists out there, we are going to be looking for some original art for the next series of art exhibitions that we will be posting on the walls here at the church. So go through your stuff and find something you'd like to share with us here. You can also see a list of some of our weekly and monthly events that are coming up soon. And tons of other stuff. So take a look. Find some fun things to get involved in. Also, a big thank you to everyone who came out for the work weekend yesterday. Sure, that's probably good right there. There's a lot going on. Let's keep it going. Today, we are going to have the first official discussion or service that is speaking specifically about this month's theme of transformation. Last Sunday, we had a fun question and answer service. So I'd like to just introduce you a little bit to the topic by reading a quick quote by Grace Lee Boggs. To make a revolution, people must not only struggle against existing institutions, they must make philosophical/spiritual leap and become more human beings. In order to change and transform the world, they must transform themselves. So now we will go to our opening hymn, number 12, O Life. Did I miss the chalice? My goodness. No, I do have, okay, so if Rob Morrison could come up and light the chalice for us. I don't know how that got out of order on that page. My apologies. And then I will read some words by Starhawk. Our way out involves both resistance and renewal, saying no to what is, so that we can reshape and recreate the world. Our challenge is communal, but to face it, we must be empowered as individuals and create structures of support and celebration that can teach us freedom. Creation is the ultimate resistance, the ultimate refusal to accept things as they are, for it is in creation that we encounter mystery. All right, so if we could now open the floor to sing the hymn. Wow. I have like several different pages here, and they all have different orders of service, and that is my own fault. So let's get it together for everyone here. So now we're going to sing opening hymn number 12, O Life That Maketh All Things New. Stand if you are able. like to open the floor to Joys and Sorrows. Who's got the mic? All right, we have. Come on along and got it? Okay.
I'm Sarah Banner, and I have two joys. Yesterday, we celebrated my dad's 75th birthday a few days early. He will be 75 on Tuesday, so if you know him, tell him happy birthday. And my other joy is that yesterday I ran a half marathon, which is the longest distance I've run since my hip surgery last year. So.
Wonderful.
This is definitely in the joy category, Michael Littlefather. Yesterday's Kansas City Star included a piece written by Nahrul Zanzami, who is an Indonesian exchange student in Kansas City this year. And the editors gave this title to her piece, A Widening View of Where Morality and Religion Intersect. She closes with this, I've been exposed to new religions, and that's made me realize that there is much more to people than their view of God. I was raised in a homogeneous community where people try to determine the quality of a person by their observance. I'm glad that I have learned to see beneath all the religious attributes that we portray. What I value in myself and others is no longer observance and piety, but rather sympathy, understanding, and respect that we have for one another as fellow human beings. To me, that is all that should matter. Love that girl, don't you?
Okay. Good morning. I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and I wrote this out today so I could get through it. But as most of you know, my mom died on Wednesday, and her dementia was very bad for a long time. She didn't even attend our son's wedding over 4 years ago because we thought she wouldn't get anything out of it. So it's been a long haul, but she was a very loving soul even till the very end, and that made her care easier for everybody. Her last leg of the race was only 4 days long, so I'm very grateful for that. And I want to thank everybody here for your offerings of flowers and that I've received, and food, and drinks, and calls, and visits, and cards, and notes, and this morning, Jake made me this beautiful corsage, which really is special. So all that really helps, and I thank those of you who worked yesterday, because I just couldn't come to the work day, but I really felt guilty, because I've worked so many of them, so anyway, thank you very much.
Hi, Linda Krieger. Many of you know that Margene Moss suffered a stroke and she's now at Via Christi, Court C. I think it's slow progress, but I know that she likes visitors. I've talked with her husband a couple times, and he says in the morning she's pretty busy with therapy, but sometimes mid to late afternoon is a good time to visit if anybody can make it over Via Christi by the Susan B. Anthony Middle School, Court C.
Tomorrow night is the beginning of Passover, which is an 8-day celebration. Passover is the celebration of freedom, and I have brought a box of matzahs, as I did last year, so you can have a bites of it in the other room, with the coffee room after services.
I wanted to thank everyone yesterday that came out and helped and worked. And if you didn't get a chance to, I'm sure you had a good excuse. But we had a good day. It was a great, cool day, and we got a lot of work done. And I hope everybody sees that. And anyway, thank you so much.
All right. For any sorrows and joys that have not been spoken, we hold those in our hearts along with the ones that have been shared with us today. And now, we are going to move along to the story for all ages. So, if you are a child or a child at heart, please come up front. I think it's working. Good morning. How are you all doing this morning?
Okay.
Fair enough. I am okay, too. I'm quite tired from a long day of gardening yesterday, so bear with me this morning, but we will see if we can liven things up a bit. All right, so I'm going to share with you a story called The Scratched Diamond. There once was a very wealthy king who owned many beautiful things. He had cloth tapestries and piles of gold and statues made by the very best sculptors in the land. Of all of his belongings, his favorite possession was the most glorious diamond you can imagine. Ooh. And it was pure. It was huge, big around as his hand, clear and flawless, without any marks or blemishes. He loved to go and sit with that diamond, gazing at its beauty and perfection. One day, when the king went to look at his diamond, he discovered, in horror, that it had a long, deep scratch. He couldn't believe his eyes. What could have happened to his flawless diamond? Immediately, he sent for all the best stone cutters and diamond cutters in the kingdom. One by one, they came to inspect the diamond. Each looked at it closely and then sadly shook his head. The scratch was too deep. If they tried to polish it, they might break the diamond into pieces. Finally, one last diamond carver came before the king. He looked at the diamond closely, gazing at it from every angle. The king watched with bated breath as the diamond carver turned the diamond over and over, pursing his lips and shaking his head. Suddenly, the diamond carver's face broke into a big smile. "I know how to fix this, Your Majesty," he exclaimed. "Leave it to me. In 2 weeks' time, I will return your diamond to you better than ever. However, you may not visit me during this time or check on my progress. You must wait until it is finished." The king was very excited. Soon his flawless diamond would be back with his other lovely things, perfect again, the scratch removed. It took all the king's willpower to resist temptation to visit the diamond carver to watch him work. As for the diamond carver, day after day, night after night, he brought out his tools to fix that diamond, bit by bit. He worked on that scratch. It was slow, tedious work. He knew he had to work carefully or the diamond would crack into pieces. Finally, the diamond cutter was finished. So he carefully wrapped the diamond in cloth to protect it. And he brought it before the king. "Here it is, Your Majesty," he said with a flourish. He opened the cloth and presented the diamond. The king gasped at what he saw. where there had once been a scratch, a horrible flaw in his precious diamond, there was now an exquisitely beautiful flower carved into the diamond. Unable to polish the scratch out of the diamond carver had instead turned the flaw into something beautiful. The king loved his diamond more than ever. Now when he went to hold it in his hands and gaze upon it, he was reminded that even something imperfect or ugly or flawed can become something exquisitely beautiful. That's the end of that story. You can now go on to your classes, and we will sing you off.
Oh, in love, our hearts go with you. Oh, in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Oh, in love, our hearts go with you. Go. Joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
I would now like to invite Therese Miller to talk to us about the Helping Hands for this month. And there you are.
It's all yours.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you about the Fairy Godmothers of Manhattan. First of all, I'd like to just thank you for your generous support last year when we were here making a presentation. So we're grateful to be back here again. And the needs are still there, as I'm sure you're all aware in this community. We are an organization of about 700 women who try to just fill a gap and help women who may just need a little bridge to, get not descend in life. So we have a grants committee, and last year we gave out about 130 grants we had, which amounted to about $60,000. The grants are not more than $600, so that's why we are able to reach a lot of people. Our applications are processed through the Shepherd's Crossing or the Emergency Shelter or the Crisis Center. We help women who just need a little gap. Some of the typical grants that we've completed this past year, we help someone, a single mother of a 7-year-old boy who works in food service at the local, and her child is attending school, but during the summer, or she is taking classes to improve her life and become an X-ray technician. And she needed some assistance with childcare during the summer, and so we helped her with that. Another need that seems to be very prevalent is auto repair for just someone to get to work. It's really important to have good, reliable transportation. Even though in this community we've been able to have some public transportation, it's not always easy to take your child to daycare and get to your job and then be able to make that work through a bus system. So those are some of the things we try to help them with, an auto repair or car insurance and registration. Those are all things that just help them in the day-to-day needs of doing that. We have also purchased helping women with dental work. That seems to be another, big need in our community. There are, of course, that's very expensive, and the amount of money that our grants include do not usually pay for everything, but at least it's a great help to them to either provide them a better look so that they can, you know, get a job and also a more comfortable life. So those are things that we all take for granted that help with that particular thing in their life. We have, as I mentioned, about 700 women. I think some of you are already fairy godmothers that I see in this room. I know that, and thank you for that connection. We have we're not an organization that has meetings and things like that. We have a board that directs some of our fundraising events, but basically we just have a grants committee that works very hard to find the people in need and match them up with what we can do to help them. So thank you again for allowing me to come and just share with you what we try to help people with. And we're very, very grateful for that opportunity. If you have more questions, I'll be here for a little while. So thank you for again.
Thank you very much for sharing more information with us this morning. We are now going to do the... Yeah, we're going to collect the offering. Don't worry, I was on it this time. I had my eyes on the right thing. All right, so take it away. All right, I think we've gotten it set up. We're now going to show you a brief video that John Alou and I saw, and it reminded us very much of this month's theme. So sit down and enjoy Today I Rise. Now I invite you all to stand as you are able and join in singing hymn number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day. When I was meeting with Jonalu about today's theme, and we were talking about various experiences and ideas that we have around the idea of transformation, she was like, hey, you should share some of these personal stories you shared with me. And I said, okay, and now I'm terrified. Anyone else relate to that? You know, personal stories, you don't know. I tried about 12 times to write out something really well shaped, you know, to really encapsulate and have some sort of really profound, meaningful, you know, thing to share with the community here around this theme. And none of it stuck. So I am going to half wing it off of these notes, and you all can bear with me. Because that's the kind of people you are, and that's why I love it here. So, when it comes to, So I have had some very wonderful experiences with community that were able to, that I could say led to transformation for myself, and that I've also seen provide transformation in a communal context as well. But in order to have those transformations make sense, you probably need a little context. So if you could say that first I was afraid, I was petrified, and so very much like the scratch diamond, I was petrified, deeply scarred, all too aware of my flaws, on the verge of shattering under the pressure to be perfect, flawless, blameless, and absolutely terrified of what horrific damage I might be capable of causing if I were to fall apart and my shards were shooting out everywhere. So needless to say, you know, when I was a kid through now. My inner life was pretty intense, you know. I had a very powerful imagination, heightened sensitivity to all things suffering, a brain that just would not quit with the anxious thoughts about deeply disturbing, depressing, horrifying existential things. I felt completely helpless and completely responsible. And because of that, some of that was, I found out later in life and came to terms with, was due to my family being very much predisposed to low serotonin. So some of that meant that I literally did not have some of the structures in my brain to help support my not falling apart. And then I also realized, because we are not just, our minds and ourselves are not just what's in our brains, but also through our interconnections with others in the world and the environment, I was not surrounded by social structures either that were very supportive of helping prevent me from falling apart. And I was desperate to learn how to live in a way that I could live with. because I was very aware of the consequences of being human in the negative sense, the damage that we were doing to each other and to the world, and suffering and horrible, horrible, horrific violence and things like that. And so I needed to both develop structures of support within myself, but then also, before I could even really get started with that, I needed structures of support outside of myself. So where do you find that? The places that I found some of the most transformative structures were in the theater and in cooperatives. So when I went to college, pretty much all of my coping skills started to fail, and pardon my French, shit hit the fan. And so I... It forced me to kind of deal with my demons and really search for the kind of support that I needed in order to be able to not just survive, but perhaps even thrive. And it kind of both happened simultaneously, so I'm not really sure what to say came first, the chicken or the egg, or the theater or the co-ops. But what I found in the theater were tools for creating that safe space in which to practice and explore different ways of being in the world. And you could see, does this way of doing it work? Am I getting the kind of, is the way that I am being in this body in relation to others in this context that's imaginary at this point, so it's relatively safe, is it working the way that I would want it to? Is this how I would want to be in the world? Does this fit me? And you could make a mistake, and it's not a real, the consequences are not permanent. also, just in terms of, I mean, you can also find yourself in theatrical situations that are not safe or do not feel safe, but I was fortunate enough to... be able to just learn about concepts and processes, as well as find myself around some really great people who were very good at helping to develop that sort of a safe space to challenge and explore different power dynamics and different ways of expressing your voice, telling a story, and processing the kinds of traumas that we as human beings go through. And also to celebrate when we kind of find a way to step into our own power. And then in housing cooperatives, I found structures that allowed me to say, okay, so most of the housing cooperatives, it was mostly housing cooperatives that I was a part of, but also food co-ops and other things. And that's where I was able to kind of develop more so the real-life relationships that are necessary to take action in the real world. And I was able to intentionally, with other people, we agreed upon enough of a sense of what is it that we want to accomplish together. Most of them were sustainability themed, also social justice and all these other things. And then coming up with goals and practices that we wanted to do as a group toward those goals. And in that setting, you're not just, it's also kind of like a practicing, because it's not the same as just living on your own. Or even just living with a family, there's another layer of accountability there with the meetings of coming together, talking about both the larger goals of, like, okay, so we really wanted to dramatically reduce the amount of garbage we produce. How did that go? And then also, did everyone actually do their night of dishes this week? Whatever it is. There was that accountability. But it was a supportive accountability, not like a condemning one. And there was always, okay, so this worked, this didn't. Let's talk about it and move forward. And I found through both of those that having that combination of support toward a common goal while also recognizing the differences that different people might bring to approaching that, and then also the accountability piece was huge because I was completely stuck. I didn't know how to make a decision or take action in any way. And so having people there to kind of provide that external support when my internal support was not there, to be like, well, this is, we're working on this. Come on now, let's go. Really helped me to kind of make progress toward feeling like I could live in the world in a way that I could live with. So that's what I've got to say about that, and I'm going to hand it over to Jonalee. Okay.
So when I saw that transformation was the April theme, I thought, oh, great, transformation, changing people to change the world. That's what religion is all about. The core of religion, and it's in the spring. How perfect is the world around us transforms with all these buds and beauty and Easter and Passover and hope and rebirth and great symbols like newborn lambs and butterflies. That'll be fun. And I totally forgot how crappy transformation really is. And by that I mean it is messy. It is unpredictable. It is controversial, and it does not feel good to be in the middle of it. We can talk all that caterpillar to butterfly miracle rubbish, but have you ever been in a cocoon? It is not a fun place. The caterpillar inside the chrysalis is literally digesting itself, actually using its own digestive juices to break down its body into undifferentiated cells, cells that can become different things. Well, not all of its body. There are pieces that remain intact, like the tracheal tubes, for instance. Plus, there's some stuff in there already, imaginal discs that are prepared under the right circumstances to turn into butterfly parts, eyes, antennae, legs, mouthpieces, genitals, and of course wings. Wings, that's our big sign of transformation, isn't it? Those huge, glorious wings. Wings that allow the butterfly to take off and soar, leaving behind its old life limited to a small patch of earth to be able to travel anywhere, or at least on its instinctual migration path. Now, entomologists, is that more or less right? So, of course, metaphors like caterpillars turning into butterflies cannot fully represent what we call human transformation. But I want to introduce the idea that transformation is not easy or pleasant, except perhaps in the presence of later comfort when we've totally forgotten about the labor pains. Another aspect where I draw on the caterpillar metaphor, the caterpillar has no idea what's going on. Yes, of course, insects have no self-awareness, despite Kafka's Metamorphosis and Jiminy Cricket and all the cute little animated bugs that have appeared on screen since. The point is that transformation happens to the caterpillar, based on stuff going on inside it, hormones and such, but outside the poor little caterpillar's voluntary control. So, have I got you excited about transformation yet? It's a messy, horrible process outside your control, and you don't know what you'll have at the end of it. Nobody would sign up for that voluntarily. And yet, transformation is exactly what religion calls us to. I heard Michael Tino, a UU colleague this week, in the context of controversy around discriminatory hiring within the UUA, say, being comfortable is not the point of religious transformation. Being comfortable is not the point of religious transformation. What then is the point of religious transformation? Why would we even want it? Other religions certainly have staked their claims on transformation. Many of us are most acquainted with religious transformation through the idea of individual salvation, being born again as a Christian. And for many people, that's a deeply emotional experience that changes their relationship with God and with the world. My own experience of individual salvation in the Baptist Church was more cynical. When my brother, a year younger than I, went forward on an altar call to give his life to Christ, I thought, if he's saved, then I must be, because I'm more of a Christian than he is. So I went forward too, and that may explain why my conversion had its limitations. Some Eastern religions offer the idea of enlightenment, awakening, or satori as a kind of transformation. And some see that as an incident where insight comes that leads to an experience of bliss. Others call it a realization of unity with all. Some think of it as a particular experience in a moment, while others see it as a state of realization that's achieved only through a lifetime of spiritual practice. Many Buddhist practitioners warn against confusing passing mystical encounters with true enlightenment, which they say is a surrender of all desire. Salvation and enlightenment are particular types of religious transformation. Whole sects grow up around particular practices and sets of belief to achieve these particular ends. But other kinds of transformation may also have a religious underpinning or tone. The day you decide you have to quit drinking. The moment you receive the cancer diagnosis. The process of grief you endure as you mourn the death of your spouse or sibling or child or parent. Life-changing events, crises often soaked in pain, stimulate transformation. Crises can be positive, too. Coming out, experiencing the birth of a new child, awakening to a new career path. The point, though, is that transformation brings an overarching change to multiple parts of our lives. Though there is continuity between who we were and who we become, so much has changed that we say we're a new person. Unitarian Universalism is more modest in its aims than many religious traditions, but has an element that points toward transformation. Our third principle includes the encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Spiritual growth may seem less flashy and ambitious than enlightenment or salvation. Spiritual growth feels more gradual and ongoing. But growth and transformation are about the same thing, change. We may see one as a steady, measured march and the other as a rapid sprint, but they both boil down to change. As I said a moment ago, transformation often comes in response to crisis, when one cannot go on living as one has and has to turn some other direction. But where? Some years back, I learned something about learning from UU minister Gary Blaine, and even though my original career was as a teacher, I'd never fully realized this, but as soon as I heard it, I knew it was true. The first stage of really significant learning, of truly taking in a new way of organizing your view of the world, is a place of utter confusion. Confusion is the sign that your current way of organizing knowledge and making sense of the world no longer works. You've been introduced to a fact that doesn't fit. You can cram it and force it, or you can deny the fact and just set it aside. Or you can reconstruct your world. When you're in that place between worldviews or worlds, you're readying yourself for transformation. Lots of people resist transformation by denying the reality of things they see in front of them, whether their own mortality, climate change, or persistence of white privilege or male privilege or so on. Denial is a really effective strategy. It can stave off transformation for years, for lifetimes. Besides denial, another resistance tactic is to accept the truth of the facts but refuse to allow them to change anything else in your world. So you might accept that climate change is real and that humans are the instigators, but continue to embrace the idea that the bottom line economic benefits are the only factors that matter in decision making, and not allowing the facts to matter in how you proceed, staving off the crisis for another day. And here's a secret that I have confirmed over and over again. Most people do not have a coherent worldview. Rather, they have, and we've got to confess, someone confessing that over here. They have different philosophies they apply in different parts of their lives. So they say God is love, but only apply the love of God narrowly to people like them. Or they have one set of eyes for their business life and another for the way they relate to their children. The virtues they extol in one aspect of their lives, they keep on hold in others. And usually it's not so conscious as Machiavellian scheming or as pretentious as hypocrisy. Mostly it's just poor self-awareness and lack of reflection about the fit between our values, beliefs, and actions. If we want to live an integrated, whole, honest life, though, and some of us seem driven to do that, when we encounter the ways that our behavior does not match our values, or that our values don't align with themselves, we're forced into transformation. And eventually that causes a realignment of beliefs, attitudes, values, worldview, and actions. That's what I mean by transformation, a realignment of beliefs, attitudes, worldview, and actions. But we have to start in confusion, in that goo of the caterpillar inside the chrysalis, in between. This is a meditative poem by Reverend Kate Walker. In between, liminal, that space where we wait, between moments, events, results, action, no action. To stand on the threshold, waiting for something to end and something new to arrive, a pause in the rumble of time. Awareness claims us, alert, a shadow of something different. In between, invitation and acceptance. In between, symptom and diagnosis. In between, send and receipt of inquiry and question. In between, love given and love received. Liminality, a letting go, entering into confusion, ambiguity, and disorientation. A ritual begun, pause. Look back at what once was. Look forward into what becomes. Identity sheds a layer, reaches into something uncomfortable to wear. In between lighting of the match and kindling of the oil, in between choosing of text and the reading of words, in between voices and notes carried through the air into ears to hear, in between creation thrusts ever forward. Social hierarchies may disassemble and structures may fall. Communities may revolt or tempt trust. Tradition may falter or creativity crash forward. Leaders may step down or take charge. The people may choose or refuse. In between, storm predicted, the horizon beacons. In between, theology of process reminds us to step back. In between, where minutiae and galaxies intermingle with microbes and mysteries. In between, liminal, that space where we wait, look, listen, feel, breathe. Transformation requires waiting the in-between until the way forward becomes clear. We have to wait for something beyond our control, an inspiration, a prompt, a call, something. We cannot do it on our own. There's a story of a monk who joined a monastery seeking a community that would be a support to him in his spiritual practice and be a place of grounding for him. He'd had a hard time with his family. Their interests and pursuits were so different from his own. They were people without a spiritual orientation, continually interrupting his prayers and distracting him with demands he do mundane tasks like hauling water. So he joined this monastery. The expectations were high, as it was a silent community. Wonderful, he thought, no one to blather on about pointless matters. Everyone shared equally in the tasks. The day he was supposed to cook, he found the kitchen in disarray. Pots had not been put where they belonged, and he couldn't find the rice. And he finally did and had the water heated and turned to put the rice in the pot when another monk turned and walked right into him, and the rice flew into the air, and he gasped in frustration and went to the abbot and asked for permission to go meditate in a cave on the property, alone. So he took his few belongings, including a small pot to eat out of. He laid his mat on the stone ground and prepared to meditate. And as he sat, a mosquito awakened and buzzed past him, and distracting him from his spiritual state. It buzzed back and forth across the cave until he could stand it no longer, and he seized the pot and flung it at the bug, and the pot burst into shards against the cave wall, and in that moment, he realized his anger had never come from those around him, but from his own heart. And he returned to the monastery, prepared to do the work of transformation required of him. What then does a community of transformation do to support that process? Process of transformation. A community of transformation is not a cocoon, not a cave that shelters and protects us, not a way of isolating ourselves from the rest of the world in a hard chrysalis where nothing out of the outside world gets in while we respond only to the internal hormones acting on us. Whatever its form, from a 12-step group to a commune to a church, even a family, a community of transformation does two basic things. It supports us and it challenges us. And these two functions do not act as opposites or even as separate steps. Often they act together even within the same sentence. They may be in tension with one another, but are most effective working together. And let me say what I mean by each of them. Support is acceptance of others as they are, where they are, and more than that, acceptance of where they'll end up. You can be who you are, and you can grow into who you are becoming. So we don't demand that people remain who they have come, who we've come to know them as. We see them as they are, the perfectly imperfect beings that they are, and accept them with their temper or their arrogance or their oversharing, and we love them anyway. We see their best self shimmering in beauty inside and around the self that they present, treasuring this unique soul for all that it is, for all that it has been, and for what it has the potential to become. And at the very same time, a community of transformation challenges. And by challenge, I mean the community forces us to confront ways our lives don't add up. Because the community loves not only who we are, but the potential we have, and it calls us to that potential. The community of transformation notices when our worldview is jumbled or when our actions fall short of our ideals. It calls us into account, demanding we own up to the effects of our own action and inaction. And because support is always part of the challenge, it loves us anyway while saying, you can do better. Sometimes it pushes us into confusion. Sometimes it helps us find our way out of confusion and holds us wherever we are. Now, sometimes the way the community challenges is subtle. The challenge may come in silently recognizing oneself in a sermon or reflection and recommitting to a change without anyone else even knowing what happened. Or the challenge may come dramatically, publicly, even painfully. For example, when a leader is held to account for failing to fulfill commitments to the community. Either way, the challenge is accompanied with support, with the ideal of love. Now, any of you who have been parents know how difficult it is to find the right balance of all these factors. You love your children exactly while they are, as they are, while having goals for them that require them to do better than they to be better than they are. It sounds contradictory, but it really isn't. If you wanted your children to remain exactly as they are, you would infantilize them and keep them stuck in habits that won't help them in the long run. When they're infants who can't understand you, you talk to them anyway because it's the only way they ever will understand you. Yet you know that if you focus only on what they ought to become, you risk losing the most precious and unique parts of them. So you love their best selves, even when you don't completely understand them. And that's what a community of transformation does. Of course, I'm stating ideals that no community will ever fully embody because it's made up of imperfect human beings. Life is messier than the ideal. We have standards that are greater than what we can achieve, and that's part of what makes us human. And without these human imperfections, I wonder if transformation would even be possible. Well, it wouldn't be needed. I don't know if I would ever have learned about boundaries without other people rubbing up against my boundaries and forcing me to. I know that I would never have become who I am without the people in various communities who have hugged me and yelled at me and encouraged me and talked me down. I especially appreciated those who lovingly told me when I had screwed up. We can only grow into our best selves in the presence of other people, not in a cave meditating alone. The context in which we find transformation matters. And since we have a degree of freedom as human beings, we make choices about our context. We can choose to place ourselves to be part of a community of transformation, or we can choose to avoid it. No guarantee either way whether or not the transformation will come, but I'm betting it's more likely in a community that both supports and challenges us. I thought about this as I read words recently on a Facebook post by Natalie Briscoe, the regional leader in the southern region of the Unitarian Universalist Association. These are her words. The purpose of the church is not to have the church. Unitarian Universalism can save the world, but we don't let it. We lock it away in scaffolds and structures. We confine it in to process and systems. We build walls to hold it prisoner. We keep our mouths closed when we should scream. We keep our hands still when they should work. We let fear guide us instead of love, and that is wrong. This structure, this church, this building, this person, none of that can contain the whole of Unitarian Universalism. The purpose of the church is not to keep its structures in place. The purpose of the church is to be the institutional incarnation of love on the earth. And it grows organically out of the needs of the people who are transforming the world through active, forceful, and fearless creation of love and justice. Saving the world leads to the need to feed the souls of those who are doing it. The work comes first, the structure comes second, if at all. Tearing down the structure only destroys the mission, if the mission wasn't there to begin with. If the work is clear and we understand ourselves to truly be the builders of beloved community, then this process won't destroy us. It will set us free. And that may mean be what it means to be a community of transformation, changing those within it, ourselves, and changing even our institution, reaching out to change the world. And I'll talk more about that on the 23rd. I leave you with these words from the great African-American preacher and mystic Howard Thurman. All around us, worlds are dying, and new worlds are being born. All around us, life is dying, and life is being born. The fruit ripens on the tree, the roots are silently at work in the darkness of the earth, against a time when there shall be new leaves, fresh blossoms, new fruit, such as the growing edge. It's the extra breath from the exhausted lung, the one more thing to try when all else has failed, the upward reach of life when weariness closes in upon all endeavor. This is the basis of hope in moments of despair, the incentive to carry on when times are out of joint and people have lost their reason, the source of confidence when worlds crash and dreams whiten into ash, the birth of the child, life's most dramatic answer to death. This is the growing edge incarnate. Look well to the growing edge. Our closing hymn is a challenging one, but I think a cool one. Number 1074 in the turquoise book, and it looks like we have singers to lead us on our way.
Turn the world around. We come from the mountain, living on the mountain.
Y'all did that good. The words of Joe Cherry: if we have any hope of transforming the world and changing ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort, brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and others. May we, as a people of faith, be granted the strength to be so bold, so brave, and so loving. So may it be.